On October 13, 2005, a discussion on the role of aid was held at the University of Winnipeg. The main focus was humanitarian organizations in war-torn countries and their work. The guest speakers included Major Harry Chadwick from the Canadian Forces, who served since 1987 and whose services included two deployments in Bosnia, where he was involved with humanitarian work of various kinds.
From the Canadian Forces perspective, in the last 10 years, we began to focus on what we call the three-block war, or full-spectrum operations.
Tony Palmer, director of Medicine Sans Frontières Canada, who started working for them in 1998 and has been the head of mission in Northern Sudan, and who worked as an emergency advisor during the Southern African nutritional crisis.
I don't think our response to conflict has changed any over the last decade. We still, our primary aim is still to preserve life and alleviate suffering, and we do that through the provision primarily of medical assistance.
Peter Dula, Mennonite Central Committee's Iraq coordinator, who served with the Mennonite Central Committee in Burundi and has a PhD in theology from Duke University.
What happens then is that once those lines become confused, humanitarians become legitimate targets.
James Oporia Ekwaro, coordinator of Sudan Folk Point Africa, a group involved in helping churches to think about post-war reconstruction and nation building.
The war was seen as just, both by those who were theologians, but also international law.
In this part, we're going to talk about the role of humanitarian organizations and how it has changed over the years, why Canadian forces are involved in humanitarian work, and how one can distinguish between a civilian and the military when doing humanitarian work in war-torn countries. One of the questions that was asked was what kind of roles humanitarian organizations and military have played in war-torn countries and how those roles have changed over the last decade.
From the Canadian Forces perspective, in the last 10 years, we began to focus on what we call the three-block war, or full-spectrum operations. The idea being that our soldiers deployed internationally in the course of a day may be expected to fight a pitched battle with a militia, with a well-armed militia, while or shortly thereafter conducting stability operations, typical peacekeeping missions, and on another block, perhaps a block over, conducting humanitarian assistance operations. So very much we're focusing on the idea that an average, there is no more average peacekeeping mission, but an average mission may see soldiers doing any three of those things during the course of a day. And it can be separated by geography or by time. So the three-block war is what we focus our training on now, and certainly for tonight's topic, I think at least two of those blocks are where we potentially have conflict with other peace support actors. Anyone else doing good on the field, I think from a military perspective, we refer to them as peace support actors or other actors on the field. So for us, it's just a focus on the focus away from the Cold War mentality of facing one opponent to what we see as the current contemporary operating environment. I would also say that it's generally accepted that wars of the future, and there will be, aren't going to be the son of Desert Storm. They'll look more like Somalia or Chechnya. So. Failed and failing states is where we see ourselves being employed, and that's in those civil environments are what we train towards now.
I don't think our response to conflict has changed any over the last decade. We still, our primary aim is still to preserve life and alleviate suffering, and we do that through the provision primarily of medical assistance. However, the context in which we work are changing quite a bit, and I think one of the recent phenomenon is that we've had to deal with as an organization is that now it is our countries of origin that are actually taking part in some of these conflicts, whether that's in Afghanistan or whether that's in Iraq. You have, in Afghanistan's case, Canadian soldiers there. In previous conflicts, we dealt with the warring parties, and they didn't have an affiliation with us. So we were finding it harder to let people know is that we don't carry the same desires, goals, or outcomes that the Canadian military has, as an example. I mean, we first and foremost don't see ourselves as an example, one of the contradictions, as a peace support operator. To us, humanitarian assistance, it's not a part of the peace. Humanitarian assistance is basically preserving life and alleviating suffering. There's no politics getting involved there. We neither are for war, and we're not against war either. And basically, we acknowledge that there is war. I mean, we base our actions on Geneva Conventions, which, for lack of a better, to paraphrase it, is basically the rules of war. And within that, there are obligations that both militaries and all militaries have to respond, whether you're an occupying power or whether you're state authorities. And also there's room and capacity for independent, impartial, neutral actors to take part in as well. And that's what we would consider ourselves as. So to quickly try to answer the question is that one of the worrying things that we are seeing is that aid is becoming, not as an end, humanitarian assistance is not an end in itself, which is what we see it as, but simply a part of a political or a military objective. So it's becoming integrated, as was mentioned by Major Chadwick. And that's something worries us because we don't want to be seen as a part of an integrated response. We want to be seen as a humanitarian reaction to a situation. We want to be there without politics, without carrying that baggage. And we think, and for access to be there for us in the future, that is essential.
At the end of the Cold War, the first thing that Christian Aid discovered was there was no money for development. There was lots of money for humanitarian work. That generally continues to be the case. In Britain at one point, our person in charge of the press called up the Sun newspaper to cover deaths in Sierra Leone in the 90s. And she was asked by the Sun, how many are dying a week? So she said, perhaps in the thousands. She said, no, not good enough. Not good enough. Come back to us if there are 5,000 above. So the focus on sensational humanitarian news became a peculiar, especially in my post-Cold War phenomenon, not exclusively, but very peculiar in pursuit of political agendas that have yet to be understood clearly. I say this because if you look at the Africa fighting against colonialism for liberation, the war was seen as just, both by those who were theologians or Christians, but also the international law, the right to self-determination, up to and including taking up arms, was justifiable. But even during those wars, neither the ANC, nor Frelimo, nor MPLA, nor PIGC in Guinea had a humanitarian wing. So from the point of view of the experience in general of the wars during colonial times, fighting for decolonization, the type of wars that took place did not engage the liberation movements in management of a humanitarian nature, of a humanitarian crisis. These wars were seen as national liberation wars. There was less to do with humanitarian activity as such. It's not that there were no humanitarian emergencies, but there was no talk of a humanitarian crisis at the time. What happens after the Cold War is the challenge of wars that began to be called humanitarian. And that for me is still a major thing to be categorized, to be understood, why these other wars broke out. I still think two things from Christian experience matter. We still yet do not understand the Cold War, just in case we think we've done away with it. We still do not yet understand it. Let alone the causes of wars, including humanitarian wars, in the post-Cold War era. So I'll stop there by saying these things have changed the character.
Another question that was asked was why Canadian forces are involved in humanitarian work.
I think we sort of chartered since
Chartier since the Cyprus peacekeeping days was a need to repair fractured societies, civil societies. So we've developed tools to do that. Civil military cooperation is just one way of we like to say that our job is to cooperate and coordinate amongst the various actors on the field. Clearly, in some situations, that's not going to be possible. CIMIC is one tool whereby we hope to leverage all the actors to fix the fractured society. We recognize that we're never going to get out of Afghanistan, for instance, if there's not a legitimate government that has the support of the people, that provides basic services to their people. General Hillier said, said that we can patrol to the cows come home in Kabul, and if there isn't a police force, if there isn't a government, if there isn't education and hospitals, we're never going to change anything. So we've developed tools that we think allow us to better repair a civil society. Now in the military, we don't have, in the Canadian military, we don't have the capability to really professionalize a judiciary. We don't have an ability to create an education system. So what we do is try and leverage those organizations that can do that. It's not, we accept that we're not the right people to do it, but someone has to do it, or we're never going to get to leave a place like Afghanistan. The Disaster Assistance Response Team, being a purely humanitarian focused military unit, they don't work in conflict zones. They're not designed to work in conflict zones. I think the possibility for the military to do humanitarian-like activities is increased in situations where we're not active belligerents. In southern Afghanistan, not everybody likes to think about it, but we are active belligerents in the conflict. We are never going to, nothing we do will satisfy the humanitarian imperative, because we're belligerents in the conflict. So the possibility of cooperation with aid agencies decreases as our likelihood of military operations increase. In the tsunami, the response to the tsunami, where we deployed the DART to Sri Lanka, because there was no likelihood of us being an active participant in the conflict, the opportunity for cooperation is quite high. I would just say, regardless of when, of what type of tool we deploy from the military, sending the military is an overtly political act. We never deploy as a completely neutral force in a peacekeeping operation. I like to think we were in, the DART is a neutral force. It was designed merely to alleviate suffering. But in an armed conflict, a disaster is brought about by an armed conflict, it's very easy to think that we're neutral, but we're not. The Taliban don't accept that we're neutral. Anything that looks like aid that we do is not, does not meet the humanitarian imperative. We're not going to give it to a village controlled by the enemy equally. So we accept that what we do, it is not humanitarian assistance in that light. It may look like it, but it's not.
When we speak about it from the MSF perspective, I think it's, I need to be clear here. We don't have anything against the military per se, them undertaking any type of activities. Our concern is the way they undertake activities and how they portray what they are doing undermines our ability to provide assistance down the road, undermines our ability. And at the end of the day, I think it would be a grave injustice if we are not able to provide assistance to those who need it. Like I've sort of mentioned, the military undertakes humanitarian initiatives with political, economic, or military objectives in mind. And that is not why we undertake humanitarian assistance. So if we are, in the end of the day, seen as one and the same, whether you're doing it through the military or a not-for-profit agency or an NGO, whatever you may call it, I think at the end of the day, what you do is you eliminate access for everybody. When we go in, when we work in Liberia or Afghanistan or Sudan or in the past Iraq as well, we don't go in there with armored military convoys. We don't go there with military escorts. We go out there on this implicit understanding with the warring parties. Look, we don't care who's right or who's wrong in this conflict. We don't have a vested interest in who wins or who loses this conflict. Our only concern is the well-being of the civilian population. And it's irrelevant to us what side of the line they are on. And so we make this implicit agreement with them. You allow us access, we will treat them. We won't get involved in politics, etc. And I think this is the, you know, so it's not humanitarian space we are defending, it's the ability to treat people, their right to have access to assistance. And to us, humanitarian action is defined by needs. And, you know, so we'll talk, I mean, one of the principles is impartiality. So it's based on needs, solely needs. It's without discrimination, and it's proportional. The response is proportional to the needs. So you don't just go to a specific area and provide that aid to that area only. You have to take it and look in light of the entire context and see where aid is needed most and allocate your resources accordingly.
Another question that was asked was how one distinguishes between civilians and the military when providing aid in war-torn countries.
When I worked in the Caucasus, so the conflict in Chechnya, which has spilled over to Ingushetia or not, this was a large concern of the Russian military. I mean, they had a very difficult time between distinguishing between civilian actors and military actors and rebels and whatnot. They saw them as one and the same. But, you know, we don't sit there and try to judge who is a civilian and who's not. It's basically upon the context. Even, by Geneva Conventions, a military combatant, once he's laid down his arms, by definition, is a civilian. So if we encounter people who aren't there with guns, are basically requiring medical attention, we provide that medical attention. We don't go back and try to connect the lines and say, are they somehow connected to this conflict? Because if we started engaging in that in ourselves, it would become a complete nightmare. We would never know who we could or could not treat. So as long as they are not in uniform and carrying a gun, and they require assistance, we provide it.
In Iraq, it's not just military and humanitarian, but also private companies, contractors, Bechtel, Halliburton are names you have heard. What happens then is that once those lines become confused, humanitarians become legitimate targets, or can be seen as such, and I think that's been a big worry since the kidnapping of several of Western aid workers a year ago. And some of my colleagues there say that, you may have heard of how so many of the journalists were embedded with the troops, that what the American coalition tried to do was also embed the NGOs, and it not only endangers aid workers, but it also kind of sucks the humanitarian community into the military project in ways that I think are very unhelpful.
I just wanted to give everybody an example of something he said. This is something former Secretary of State Colin Powell said. And this is with regards to Afghanistan. He referred to NGOs or not-for-profit organizations as force multipliers and an important part of the American combat team. So, I mean, clearly this is the perception that some of the military have of what agencies such as MSF and other organizations have. And clearly we think this is a very dangerous way of portraying humanitarian agencies, and I think this is what we also have fears about the Canadian military as well. We are not interested in being coordinated by whether it's the UN or the Canadian military. We believe in exchange of pertinent or relevant information and communications, but we don't believe that there should be one single body that coordinates all responses. And when the question was asked earlier, what's changed, this has really changed. You have these ideas that there should be one body coordinating the entire political, military, economic, and humanitarian process in a given country. And we think this is a dangerous path to be moving towards.
I wanted just to add to that, I mean, it's important to say that it's not just the military's fault here. That, a lot of NGOs are more than happy to provide this service for states, for military actions. So it's not fair to just say this is, I mean, Colin Powell was right when he said that, just insofar as aid agencies were ready to play that role.
in the Canadian military, CIMIC is seen as a combat multiplier. We're not so open to say that you are called a combat multiplier. We are, because we can find a way to work with you. a little more subtle. We do think there is somebody in Afghanistan who should be doing the coordinating. We think it's the Afghan government. The Army, again, which is an instrument of the Canadian government. The Canadian government has decided that we will support the creation of a civil society, the establishment of rule of law, and the government of Afghanistan. So what we do is towards that end, supporting the Afghan government. In the military, we're always talking about exit strategy. I can tell you any army only dreams of being back on an army base somewhere and doing training. All we want to do is stop doing operations and do training, which is what we do best. So we want to get out of Afghanistan as fast as possible. 10, 15 minutes, we'd like to get out of there. We know that we cannot get there unless you do your work. So we accept in the 90s in Bosnia, the relationship between the military and aid organizations and NGOs had grown too close. As we accept that. For us now, the greatest danger to operations in Afghanistan is aid agencies leaving. We see that as a significant threat to the mission. And when MSF suspended operations last year, I think it was the year before, that was a blow to our mission. Not because we can control them. We would far better not control them and have you stay than have aid agencies leave. Because whether we can control aid agencies or not, we know that if they don't do their work, we're never going to go home. And exit strategy is everything that's not okay. So.
I don't think that is the greatest danger in Afghanistan. I think the greatest danger in Afghanistan is the presence of the alien troops, is the presence of an occupation. It was stated, he went back in 1997 by Brzezinski in a book. He wrote about what the world should look like. And it's a standard text now, but he mapped it out in 1997 and said, he who controls Central Asia shall control most of the world. But what are the powers we have if you control Central Asia? You have Russia under watch. You have China under watch. You have potential India under close watch. You have Japan and other Asian countries under watch. It is not by accident that these forces are there. I would like us to address the bigger questions, although I respect very much what you said about the Canadian tradition. Certainly Canada has a much better tradition of peacekeeping than other countries, especially your neighbor. I think that's the language here in the South. It used to be fascinating for those of us who have to negotiate with Americans. I still do not understand how a country can sit and say, we ask for peacekeeping troops from America. It does not exist. It has never existed, and there's no intention for the kind of peace that we, I think, in this room would be interested. They are interested in the balance of stability by the domination of the big power. They have demonstrated that in many ways. My interest in this debate has been to say something like this. Yes, we speak about humanitarian, but remember, many of these countries in the third world, or the south as we prefer to call them, were told to structurally adjust. Remember the structural adjustment program? And you remember we spoke about state failure? Well, Mr. Blair, the man over there in Britain, began a program on state failure. My friend Sally from Britain was put in charge. They call it a command post. They even use military language. Within a year, they discovered that we were going to tell them where state failure came from. It came from imposition of structural adjustment programs. What can you get for state failure? Then when there's a little flood around, there's no police, there's no system, you have then a humanitarian crisis. What do? You end up importing the good friends, MSF, and ourselves, Christianity, and so on. So let's talk about the fundamental. What happened?
You have been listening to a discussion about the role of humanitarian aid in war-torn countries. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and you are listening to CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM Winnipeg.